the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The goal of the census is to count each and every person who lives in the U.S. The pandemic has thrown a huge wrench in the mechanics of going door to door, and now that's all ending a month earlier than originally planned. Plus, waiting for an unemployment check and got bills to pay? Well, there's a wrench in that too, and L.A.'s economy is paying a pretty steep price. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're going to remember the founder of a legendary Koreatown restaurant, BCD Tofu, and we'll find out how other eateries in that L.A. neighborhood are being hit by the pandemic. Also, friends.
If people are like us in that their friends really are an important part of their social life, that is just something that is really front of mind.
The host of the podcast, Call Your Girlfriend, have written a book about navigating our adult friendships through pandemics and life's many other curveballs. But first, we're going to start with news today that the Census Bureau announced that in-person census work will be cut short this year. Door-knocking census takers will stop visiting homes on September 30th, not October 31st, as previously planned. Here to talk about what this shortened timeline means for us here in California, I'm joined by Doug Johnson, a research affiliate with Claremont McKenna College. Doug, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
All right, just to back up a little bit, the timeline for the 2020 census already moved around this year. So how is the count supposed to go, and how has that plan changed?
So there are three steps for the Census Bureau to complete this count. The first is what we call self-response, where they ask people to just report on your own. This is what's been done over the internet. You can also do it by phone. And anyone can do that. You just go to the website, enter your address, and provide the information they want. And hopefully, all this controversy will fire more people up to go and do that. The second stage is what we're talking about, which is the census follow-up operation. This is where the Bureau goes door-to-door to households that haven't responded yet. And they come armed with tons of information about why it's important to respond, why the information is private. And that is really the key to getting a full count. That tries to get us from about two-thirds of households counted, as close as possible to 100%. There's actually a third stage that's little talked about, where if the Census Bureau knows there's someone in a house but can't get any information on them, they will actually statistically guess at who's in that house based on the neighborhood. And they try to keep that down to about 2% because it's somewhat random and not as accurate, but that's how they'll try to fill in the rest of the data at this time. If we have a 10% non-response rate, even after door knocking, that's a massive amount of imputation they'll have to do. And now, as you mentioned, the Bureau has just changed its position, and instead of delaying the count 3 months, they're going to try to get everything done on the regular time frame, but it's going to be a Herculean task and almost impossible for them to get the scale of coverage that they would like to get.
Yeah, it does sound like it's going to be very, very difficult. All right, so door knocking will only happen for less than 2 months this year. Historically, Doug, has the in-person part of the census ever been that short before?
You know, I don't know if it's ever been that short, but certainly that is shorter than they had planned. And the real crippling part, it's that they lost all their hiring and training time. So I think about 2 months, maybe 3 months might be the standard door knocking time. But that assumes that they have hired and trained these hundreds of thousands of door knockers in advance of that. And now the Bureau is trying to essentially hire and send them out simultaneously. And going to be a problem, without a doubt.
Now, the Census Bureau's mission, in case anyone doesn't know, is to count every person in the United States. So why would they make their job so much more difficult by giving themselves less time to do this difficult job?
Actually, we know for sure it's not even the director of the Census Bureau making these decisions, because he was testifying right after the latest citizenship memo came out, and he commented that he had not been involved and had not seen the memo before it was released to the media. And so, yes, there's been no real explanation about, well, how to put it, there's been no official explanation of why the White House has rescinded its support for the delay. But there's a lot of speculation, I think probably well-informed speculation, that this is all tied into what the White House is hoping to do with citizenship data. If there's no delay, then the counts of members of Congress by state come out while President Trump is still in office. if there was the 3-month delay that was originally planned, then the odds are President Trump would no longer be in office when that data becomes available. And he wouldn't be able to try the citizenship games he's trying to play with the apportionment counts of members per state.
Talking to Doug Johnson, research affiliate with Claremont McKenna College, about the scrunch timeline for the census here in California. All right, let's talk consequences. Which state communities are going to be missed with in-person outreach being cut back?
The in-person outreach is most important for those areas that the Census Bureau calls hard-to-count neighborhoods, areas with lots of renters or relatively lower income or that speak foreign languages predominantly, because those areas tend to not self-respond as often. So our wealthier, whiter areas will get self-response rates in the 80% range. They don't take a lot of follow-up. In the areas that aren't as tuned in and as willing to do what government asks them to do on their own because of, you know, all the controversy over citizenship and other reasonable considerations, they need that door-to-door knock to get the full count. And that's our Latino communities. That's our heavier renter communities in our lower income areas.
Now, we all know there's a lot of money at stake in the census. Doug, what does that mean for those communities if they are not accurately counted?
It is a huge price. For every person counted, the state, the county, and the city and the schools get about $2,000 per year. So if one person is missed, that's $20,000 over the course of a decade that's lost out. And if we miss 100,000 people, you know, we're into the billions of dollars over the decade that the community should have received from the federal government that it won't.
Yeah, money and representation too, right? I mean, that also changes if the count isn't done accurately.
Exactly right. Our voice in Sacramento and our voice in Washington, D.C. loses out. We're almost certain to lose one congressional seat just from slow growth patterns. But this low count and the predominance is hard to count populations in California could very well cost us a second seat, meaning California have fewer voices in Washington, D.C., fewer electoral college votes for the president, and shift the representation in Sacramento as well.
Now, at this point, can the Census Bureau's decision be changed? I imagine California's representatives are probably not too happy about this news.
Well, last I checked about 2 weeks ago, there were four bills in the House that would provide the extension. And at least one, and I think two of them actually passed the House. What has really triggered all of this blowback is that the Senate has said they're not going to adopt those provisions. So, you know, Trump originally supported the change, now he doesn't. But if the House and Senate pass the change, maybe he would reverse again. But if the Senate's not going to act, then those proposals are dead. So this will all largely hang on the Senate.
That's Doug Johnson, research affiliate with Claremont McKenna College. Doug, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Usually we hit August and it's the lazy dog days of summer. No, but not 2020. This year, August comes with a lot of anxiety, especially for the unemployed. They've already lost their extra $600 a week in benefits from the federal government, and the domino effect could be massive as rent is due and many businesses still aren't hiring. Here to tell us what's going on with the unemployment in the state and at the federal level is KPCC reporter David Wagner. David, thanks for joining us on Take Two.
Great to be here.
All right, so let's start off with that $600. At the beginning of the pandemic, Congress passed the Federal CARES Act, giving a big boost to everyone on unemployment. What happened to that $600?
That's right. This was a big increase to unemployment benefits because, you know, usually unemployment just isn't enough to live on. Here in California, the state gives out a maximum of just $450 per week in benefits. So that additional $600 per week from the federal government has made it possible for people to pay rent and put food on the table. But Congress only approved those extra benefits for about 4 months, and now they've expired. Democrats and Republicans in D.C. are now locked in negotiations to extend those benefits. Democrats want to keep the $600 as is, but Republicans say people are getting paid more on unemployment than they did while working. So they either want it to be lowered to $200 per week, or they want to cap benefits at 70% of people's past wages. And it turns out that calculation would not be easy for the state to make, and there could be even longer delays in getting payments out.
David, why is that? How long a wait are we talking about?
Well, California's Employment Development Department, or EDD for short, has already been really struggling to keep up with this tidal wave of applications. You know, so far they've processed 9.3 million claims from unemployed Californians. And just to put that in perspective, that's more than double the number of claims they processed during the entire year of 2010. That was the worst year of the Great Recession. You know, they say they've been doing all of this on antiquated IT systems that badly need to be upgraded. So they say programming that brand new calculation, that 70% of past wages calculation proposed by the Republicans, you know, they say programming that into their system would be a pretty heavy lift.
You know, it does seem like EDD is already letting a lot of people fall through the cracks. You covered a hearing last week in Sacramento about problems at the department. What's the latest at EDD?
Yeah, state lawmakers really grilled EDD Director Sharon Hilliard in that hearing. They told her too many of their constituents have been going for months without benefits now. They say many of those people are in severe financial distress, but they just can't get through to anyone at EDD for help. So here's what we know about EDD's backlog. Right now, about 890,000 people still have not been paid, even though they have applied, and the department says they may in fact be qualified for benefits. Sharon Hilliard said many of those people simply haven't completed the steps necessary to certify for benefits, but she did say that the department knows of about 239,000 claims that need resolution from EDD, and she said the department isn't going to clear that backlog until September.
Wow. So some people may have been waiting, what, since March for benefits, and they still might not get paid until September. Why are these claims taking so long?
The answer from EDD is that, you know, some claims are just more complicated than others. They say, you know, maybe people entered information that doesn't match state records. And they say when that happens, it can take a lot of time for human workers at EDD to investigate those trickier claims. You know, we do have some stats on how long people are waiting. So, you know, during normal times when the economy is humming along, EDD pays about 80% of applicants within 3 weeks, but now that's down to 62%. So more than a third of Californians who've been seeking unemployment benefits during this pandemic, they've been waiting more than 3 weeks to get their benefits. The nationwide average on that metric is 69%, so California does seem to be slower than other states. And, you know, people who've applied for benefits say EDD can kind of be a black hole. They put their information in, but nothing comes out. And then when they try to call someone at EDD, they're stonewalled, they're hung up on, or they're told to call back during different hours.
Yeah, we have heard a lot of listener complaints about this call center. What do we know about what someone experiences when they actually call EDD?
So EDD has expanded its call center hours for technical support, and they have that phone line open now 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. But the department's core phone line is still only open 4 hours a day on weekday mornings. And that's the phone line staffed by fully trained caseworkers. These are really the folks that people want to reach to fix their claims. State lawmakers asked Hilliard when EDD was going to expand the hours at that core call center, but she didn't have a timeline. So, you know, for now, people on EDD's callback list are waiting an average of 4 to 8 weeks to be contacted by the department.
Any hope of things getting better?
Well, there is a lot of pressure on EDD right now to improve. Last week, the governor's office announced that they're forming a strike team to reform the department. And Hilliard said EDD is planning to do a complete overhaul of its outdated computer system, but she said that work won't even be contracted out until October, and that's just the start of what could be a really long process.
And in the meantime, it sounds like things are rough even for people who are getting benefits. That federal $600 has gone away, and who knows when that'll be replaced. So what does this all mean for LA's economy?
That's right. I mean, 20% of workers in LA are now unemployed, and they've, you know, they're facing huge problems collecting enough money to survive. You know, and we know that without those federal benefits, Californians would get a median weekly benefit of just $339. That's just not enough to get by in LA. And if that federal money isn't replaced, about half of people getting unemployment benefits in California would end up below the federal poverty line. So that's why some state lawmakers are now putting out this proposal. They say that if the federal benefits are not renewed or if they get significantly reduced, they say California should step in to fill the gap.
Can the state actually do that?
Well, in theory, yes. You know, it would be very expensive. And nothing's set in stone here yet. California lawmakers are waiting to see what happens on the federal level before committing the state to any plan along these lines. But if they did want to go this route, you know, what they would do is borrow money from the federal government and then repay the debt with higher taxes on California employers down the line. Some experts say raising taxes on employers right now when the economy is already in such bad shape could hurt our chances at recovery. But the state lawmakers say that, you know, that trade-off might be worth it in order to keep people afloat right now.
Now, losing that $600 per week must be putting people in a tough spot. When you talk to people about their plans moving forward, David, what do they tell you?
Well, some of them say they're going to have to leave L.A. I mean, I talked to one woman who produces commercials for a living. All of her shoots have been shut down. And like many freelancers, right now, she's actually getting very low unemployment benefits. So that's because the unemployment system disregards the vast majority of her past income as a freelancer. You know, she told me, look, LA is very expensive. If unemployment isn't coming through and if there's no work for me here anytime soon, I just can't justify staying in LA. And these are the kinds of decisions people are making all across the city right now.
That's KPCC's David Wagner talking to us about the latest on unemployment. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, the pandemic has caught us all off guard and hit us all very hard. And while Californians are doing their best they can to deal with the coronavirus, there are other living things in this state that are having serious problems with infections. Last month, it was fish. This month, baby deer. Find out all about it when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Now for the latest installment in our new series, Race in LA. Now in it, we ask Angelenos how race and identity shape their day-to-day lives. The essays written by both community contributors and LA staffers are published each week. And the stories are told that are aimed at fueling meaningful conversations about lived experiences as a certain race or ethnicity. This week, Eric Craig shares what his family taught him about being Black in America and how his race factored into his professional life.
I remember being hunched over my desk, staring at the computer screen clock with my hands clenched. When the clock turned to 1:30, I joined a Zoom video conference with four other interview candidates who were vying for a position on a local public transportation board. In theory, I was a perfect fit. I exceeded the requirements, used public transportation, and had a passion for service. It was in the bag. After a quick glance on the video call, there was nothing new. I was the only Black guy. It didn't matter, I thought. Well, until I learned the council was conducting a group interview with all the candidates. Then it was my turn. I remember talking, but it was an out-of-body experience. I wanted my words to be precise, like anyone would during an interview, but even more immaculate than normal. I felt an automatic duty to disprove any presumptions about me based on my race and demonstrate how articulate and knowledgeable I am. Before I knew it, I finished my piece. At the end of the call, the interviewer said they would submit the names to the board for consideration. The next day, I got an email. The interviewers recommended all of the candidates on the video call to the board, except me. It's not so much the failure that bothered me. Being turned down for opportunities is a part of life. But I pondered why I felt the need to portray myself in such an unreal manner. Why did I feel that extra pressure to perform? Why couldn't I just be me? I don't have a long story or a history of extreme racism, being called out of my name, or being denied the opportunity to grow. But I know that my life, being Black, has revolved around microaggressions and my ability to internalize them. During the summer as a kid, I would live the dream of my youth. My parents were off to work and I didn't have school, so I got to watch TV all day long at my grandmother's house. But every so often, my grandmother would call me into the kitchen as she leaned against her tile-faced countertops. I'd walk in begrudgingly time after time because, well, what could be so pressing to interrupt my TV show? Dirty dishes, a tattletale, another broken picture frame. Yes, Gamma, that was probably me again. No, it was about life being Black. Before age 10, and well after, my grandmother told me about the police and how people, mainly white people, would perceive me. I vividly remember how she demonstrated what it was like to be arrested if I committed a crime, which is something that was drilled into me before George Floyd, Michael Brown, and countless others. She would take my chubby arms and force them behind my back, telling me that the police would treat me differently because I'm Black. As a kid, I just knew I didn't want to make my grandmother upset. I promised her I would never get in trouble like that. Some people might say my grandmother was callous, unreasonable, or even destructive. Now, as an adult, I know she did it out of love. Those difficult lessons were only the beginning. In elementary school, I had the habit of turning in haphazard work, and my mother scorned me for it. Her eyes cut across my spirit when she told me that being a Black man would mean that I would have to be more than mediocre, even two times better than the competition. I was to be dressed to perfection when I went to interviews. She told me to look the interviewer in the eye, never look down, and refuse to feel inferior. Any one flaw could discredit me more than anyone else just because I'm Black. I grew up knowing that I would be criticized. I created this internal duty to always set an example. I had to carry the burden of dispelling each and every presumption based on my race. That's how I would avoid the police. That's how I would get a job. That's how a person could see me beyond being Black. And that's the mindset I grew up with. Now, I have a distressing realization that when I try to do everything right in life, I'll never be above scrutiny. A few jobs ago, I was a journalist who edited an online architecture and design website in New Orleans. One day over email, a seller I had never met invited me to an open house so I could write about it in detail. She sent me photos of her beautiful raised center hall located just off of St. Charles Avenue in a corner lot that was worth upwards of $1 million. It had tall glass windows with shutters, two gables symmetrically placed along its pitched roof, and a covered classic southern porch to die for. Of course, I agreed to tour it. I pulled up to the miniature castle right on time and approached the gate. The white real estate agent, who I recognized from the house listing, stood at the gate and locked it as I approached. "Can I help you?" she said as I furrowed my eyebrow. I asked her if I had the correct address to the home. She questioned me on how I heard about it. A moment later, I looked up to see the seller opening the front door of her home and walking down the towering steps of her center hall. She stood next to the realtor and also asked how she could help. I told her, "My name is Eric Craig. I'm writing about your home." She opened her eyes so wide they nearly popped right out of her head. "Oh," she flustered, "you're Eric Craig." She shrouded her palpable confusion with a cold, far-reaching smile. She unlocked her gate and invited me onto her property. I toured the house with some of her friends that she invited. I didn't know much about them, but I knew they were rich and white. Eventually, we took a break and had hors d'oeuvres. I've never been one to turn down free open house cheese or any kind of snack for that matter. I stood on dark hardwood floors and sat uncomfortably in a high stool next to the kitchen island. I had a soft smile on my face, not out of contentment, but discomfort. The seller's white friends tried to start a conversation with me, but it felt like they were prodding me like livestock. You're a writer?
That's impressive. How did you get that job?
You've graduated college? Oh, wow, that's amazing. Are you the first? Did you play sports? Probably football, right?
You're very articulate.
I hate entertaining microaggressions. No, I'm not some sort of miracle case that learned to read by fireside. I graduated summa cum laude. I've never played or even liked sports. At that point in my life, I've been writing professionally for 3 years. Both my mother and older sister are special education teachers with multiple degrees. We have talents just like you, I wanted to say, and not by accident. What I've accomplished wasn't an impressive feat. It was me doing the best I can with my options at the time, just like everyone else. After the tour was over and the cheese was gone, I left. I sat in my car for a second and then drove off. When I moved back to Los Angeles to advance my career, I chose to live in South LA. My friends thought I was crazy. I've heard this region called everything from a zoo to a living hell on earth, and it's true. There are many places that aren't kind and welcoming here. However, it's my home and where I grew up. Even with the scars of 1992, I don't feel judged when I'm living my day-to-day life in South LA. I don't have to code switch or internalize microaggressions, and I don't have to experience W.E.B. Du Bois's double consciousness. It's a shame, really. I have, in this country, a multitude of legislation that tells me that I'm free, equal, and worthy. But I don't feel that luxury everywhere. In the 503 square miles of Los Angeles, I only really feel relaxed in my own neighborhood. When I was that chubby kid during the summer and my grandmother forced my arms behind my back, it was an extended metaphor for my life. I'll always have the looming reality of doing everything right, but never being above scrutiny.
That was LAist contributor Eric Craig reading from his essay titled Lessons Learned While Being Black, I'll Never Be Above Scrutiny. It's part of our ongoing series titled Race in LA, and you can read Eric's story and other personal essays in the series on our website. That's laist.com, laist.com. Okay, so we can add yet another entry into the 2020 Why Are You Doing This to Us file, along with all of the just terrible things that have come along with the coronavirus pandemic. It appears that our critter friends are having issues of their own. Now, back in early July, we told you about a brand new bacterial infection that was killing tens of thousands of fish in the Mojave River hatchery in San Bernardino County. Species such as rainbow trout were suffering with bulging eyes and swimming erratically, among other strange symptoms. And the thing that made this even stranger is that the California Department of Fish and Wildlife had no idea where the bacteria even came from. They had never seen it in the state before, and it was resisting treatments to cure it. Well, now there's a virus killing deer in Northern California. Fish and Wildlife says that fawns in five NoCal counties have died from an outbreak of adenovirus hemorrhagic fever. It's rare. The last large outbreak in California happened in 1993 and 94 and killed thousands of young animals, as they are the most likely to die if they catch it. The virus causes fawns to drool, foam at the mouth, and suffer from diarrhea and seizures. And it's spread mostly when deer are gathered around water or feeding sites. So that's why Fish and Wildlife is stressing to people to be aware that it is against the law to feed wildlife. So leaving them alone and keeping your distance is really the best thing anyone can do during this outbreak. And yeah, that seems to be the boilerplate advice for all living things in 2020. Keep your distance. All right, think about your best friend, the one person on the planet that's your 100%, no doubt about it, ride or die. Maybe you got a funny how we met story or a serious how your friendship survived tale, but calling that person, you know, like your bestie or BFF is just not enough to describe your relationship. You need a better name to really get across how big this friendship is. Find out what that name is when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Journalists Aminatou Sow and Anne Friedman have been best friends for really over a decade, since meeting cute at a watch party for the teen drama Gossip Girl. So much did they dig each other's company that they started the podcast Call Your Girlfriend, which has been going strong for 6 years. But even a friendship as close as this one hits some bumps along the way. And in their new book, Big Friendship, they write about the highs and lows of their relationship and how it survived on the other side. All the way reminding the rest of us how important it is to nurture the bonds we share with friends. Last week, my colleague Libby Denkman talked with both Sow and Friedman about the evolution of their pair's friendship.
Hi, Libby.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So we can all relate to the challenges of maintaining long-term friendships, but what prompted you to write a book about it? Aminatou, can we start with you?
You know, the truth is very simple. We are two people who have been friends for 11 years now. We would like to be friends for as long as we are alive. And like every intimate relationship, we had hit a couple of road bumps. And, you know, the communication between us was not good. And we were really not understanding what was going on in our friendship. And we didn't really have a good social script or social support for figuring that out.
And what would you say was your main objective?
All of those things for me as well. And, you know, especially that point about not having a social script, I think we've also lacked a precise vocabulary at times for the type of friendship we have and some of the dynamics that have occurred within it. And we really wanted to try to put some words to this really important relationship that we share.
I have to say, I see so many books about romantic relationships or coworker relationships, but a handbook about how to navigate friendships and the experiences that you guys have had, I have never seen anything like that. And I think it's so important, especially right now when social bonds are really difficult to keep close. Aminatou, what kinds of challenges are happening right now in the world with the pandemic that we're dealing with? And do you think your book provides some help in navigating those?
Oh, man, the pandemic really is upending everyone's life in every way imaginable. You know, I think that if people are like us in that their friends really are an important part of their social life, that is just something that is really front of mind. And so while our book is not a self-help book, you will find out why as soon as you read it. We are messy people who are barely hanging on to our own existence.
That but, makes it relatable.
It's true. You know, like we are not experts at all, but we are people who just care really deeply for each other. And I think that that is, you know, that is something that is very recognizable for a lot of people. And, you know, that question of how do you stay close to someone through all of life's transitions, whether it is a pandemic or whether it is a move or whether it is one of you having a baby or one of you meeting a partner or, you know, having a really intense job. Those are things that humans are going to have to puzzle through, like for as long as we are alive.
I think what I appreciated the most out of the amount of the book that I've been able to read so far is the way that you are vulnerable about the struggles and that you're not all together. You don't have it all figured out. And could you give us a sense of the passage in the book when you both write about a party that you invited Aminatou to, and it turned out that she was the only Black woman, Black person at the party, and the difficult conversations you had after that. What were the struggles that you faced in overcoming that difficult conversation, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, well, it's worth mentioning that the incident that you describe, which was a birthday party for someone else that I hosted in my home that Aminatou attended, was not like some huge watershed moment in our friendship. You know, we write about it because it really is the kind of seemingly small, you know, relatively common incident where race can creep into the friendship between two people who maybe think that they're talking about race, you know, in a big, you know, out in the world kind of sense. But when it comes to the dynamic within the friendship and the ways that race is playing out and the level of sort of safety and security and comfort that Aminatou in particular feels in our interracial friendship, those are things that have been a lot harder for us to address. And so, you know, we write about this birthday party where, you know, she instantly noticed the racial makeup of everyone who was there and that she was the only Black person in attendance. And also noticed that it was not something that I addressed with her first. And, you know, when we really write about how the emotional burden of noticing the way race does creep into friendship often falls on the friend who is not white in an interracial friendship that involves a white person. And, you know, we were able to talk about it some months later, again, because Aminatou raised it. And I think, you know, we tell that story in part so that, you know, people feel seen in their own struggles in their interracial friendships. And also, I think for me, you know, if I had it to do over, it's something that I would have addressed more clearly and directly with her. So, you know, there maybe also is a part of this that's saying like, hey, if you're a white person in an interracial friendship, you bear responsibility for the things that happen in your home, in spaces that you curate. And you also bear a responsibility to raise that. That's part of the pact of being in this kind of friendship.
Aminatou, you talk about the difficulty of being in an interracial friendship and being the person of color and that burden that falls on you. And also the fact that you have your guard down with your friends. But then when incidents of racism or, you know, accidental bigotry may happen, then it becomes on you to whether to bring it up or not and really to take on that challenge. Do you think that it's possible to have an open and supportive relationship completely when one person is white and one person is a person of color?
I mean, I certainly think so. And, you know, I hear this question a lot, honestly, mostly from people who identify as white women. And, you know, I think that is something that is, you know, like if you are a woman, for example, who has men in your life, that's something that you are contending with as well. If you are someone who is straight and you have friends who are gay, that is probably something that you are contending with a lot. And so I think that really calling yourself into account and thinking about like, oh, what are all of the ways that I can be different in the world? And what are all the ways that other people are different than me? And how do we account for that? You know, race is not the only difference that people have. And it does not have to be an explosive kind of encounter every time.
We're talking with Aminatou Sow and Anne Friedman, who are best friends, and they are the co-hosts of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend. They also have a new book out. It's called Big Friendship. In the time that we have left, I wanted to talk about shine theory. Aminatou, can you explain what that is and why it's important to practice?
Shine theory really is the operating principle in our friendship. You know, really early on, we started telling each other, I don't shine if you don't shine. And it was just a way of reassuring each other that we were supporting each other. And I think the reason it has resonated so much with people is because it's a practice that a lot of people already have, not, you know, saying no to competition and prioritizing collaboration instead, and really being deeply invested in the people in your life and invested in the things that they want and helping them achieve their goals.
I know I'm going to take from this conversation and from the book Big Friendship, you know, that shine theory philosophy and really try to live it and practice it, because I do think, like you said, it just sounds so liberating. And I know in my life, I feel so much better when I'm building people up instead of feeling that insecurity or that jealousy of people around me. And what is the one thing that you want people to take away from the book, from the work that you guys put into this and the stories that you shared?
I would love people to respect friendship as an institution that can be absolutely life-shaping and therefore worthy of investment in. And I know we pay a lot of lip service to friendship in our society. You know, people would, I think most adults would be ashamed to say like, oh, I don't have friends. But when it comes to really saying like, oh, you know, how are your friendships? Are they healthy? Like when it comes to other ways that we support people actually staying in friendship, we make assumptions that it's going to slide to the bottom of the priorities list or that those relationships are not as intimate and fulfilling as romantic or family bonds. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, what we really want is some respect for friendships that have achieved this level of emotional depth and for us all to recognize that that's something we can decide to do. We don't need to wait for the world to change. We can respect our friendships to that degree and we can respect our friends' friendships as well.
That's Anne Friedman, and we were also joined by Aminatou Sow, the hosts of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend, and they have been talking to us about their new book, Big Friendship. Check it out, and thank you guys both for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Restaurants all over LA are trying their best to hang on and survive the pandemic. Some have been able to keep money coming in through takeout and outdoor dining, but there are many more that have suffered backbreaking losses. And for one LA neighborhood built around the restaurant industry, it's not just the restaurants that are trying to survive, it's the neighborhood itself. Find out where it is when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org. Amy Martinez. While the pandemic continues to deal blow after blow to small businesses across the country, let's take a look at the profound effect it's having on the LA neighborhood of Koreatown. Restaurants help to define the culture there, but several neighborhood institutions have either shuttered permanently or suffered debilitating setbacks. And according to the editor of the website Eater LA, Matthew Kang, it may take decades for the area to recover, maybe even until the next generation of Koreans decide to open up their own businesses. Matthew, welcome to Take Two.
Hey, welcome.
Now, thanks, Matthew, for having me. One of the most noteworthy closures was the restaurant Dongil Jang, which announced that it's closing August 15th after more than four decades. First, paint a picture of this restaurant for us. Take us in there. What's it known for?
Yeah, Dongil Jang is a real classic Koreatown restaurant. It was there for 41 years and will be open for another week and a half or so for takeout and delivery. But man, this place was just so iconic for a lot of Koreans. It was a standalone building on 8th Street, kind of decorated and sort of made to look like a classic building in mid-century Seoul, like post-war Seoul. Mm-hmm. And when you go inside, it was like wood paneling and writing on the walls, like old Korean writing on the walls. It just had this look from the late 1950s with vinyl banquettes and formica tables. It was smoky with the tabletop barbecues. The place was just an incredible scene. It was a place for a lot of Korean families celebrating special occasions and living a good life.
Like, it took you away from where we are to a different place and a different time. That was the vibe the second you walked in the door, right?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like to refer to Dongil Jang as like maybe the Musso and Frank of Korean restaurants, right? I mean, it was just transportative. You go in there and It was timeless, and it felt like the kind of place where if you're where your grandparents or your parents would go on a fancy dinner. It was perhaps a little bit more about the look and feel of the place versus the actual food, which was good, yeah. But not like nearly focused in its menu.
Now, what are the reasons it's closing down now?
Well, I spoke briefly with Roy Kim, the owner, on Instagram. And I guess with the pandemic shuttering dining rooms and really adding a lot of economic pressure and uncertainty to the restaurant business, they decided to close after 41 years. And it's really unfortunate because, like I was saying, Dongiljang is a classic restaurant. It's about the feel. It's about the setting. And when you don't have dining in, it's just not the same. It's not the same experience. We wrote a story as well on Eater LA talking about places like Casa Vega and Musso and Frank and Dantana's. Like, you just don't have the same magic if what they're offering isn't available to you. And especially with Korean food, it's such a communal dining experience. You have a tabletop grill in the middle. You're sharing the pan-fried, the kimchi fried rice at the end of a Korean barbecue meal. That is not conducive to experiencing during the pandemic, and really was one of the earlier casualties, unfortunately, of the pandemic.
Korean barbecue is Matthew tough to do as takeout. It just doesn't taste the same. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, and Korean food is takeout friendly, depending on what you get. Especially Dongiljang, they were known for their toshirak, which is sort of like a lunchbox similar to a bento. Yeah. A lot of Korean food does travel well, and I think that's why some of the Korean restaurants in Koreatown have been making do with doing takeout. But yeah, Korean barbecue is so much more about, you know, opening up a bottle of soju and just passing. Everyone's dipping into the same banchan and the same stews. It's just not the same.
Now, another Koreatown institution that suffered a blow, a different kind, is BCD Tofu House. Started right here, and it was unique because it popularized a dish in LA that eventually made its way back to Korea. So, Matthew, tell us about that restaurant, its food, and the passing of its founder.
Yes, so we reported on the death of Lee Hee-suk, or Hee-suk Lee, in sort of an English, putting it in English. But Lee Hee-suk was the founder of BCD Tofu House. And I sort of grew up with BCD Pukjangdong, named after a neighborhood in Seoul, Korea. And Miss Lee was just super important for making essentially a dish, sundubu, which is a silken tofu stew, making it, I sort of like to call it the crossover dish, of Korean food. Like, if you think of Korean dishes, a lot of people might think of Korean barbecue or bibimbap. I think sundubu is up there as like this dish that both Koreans and non-Koreans really began to love. When she opened her restaurant in 1996 in Los Angeles, she quickly expanded it across Southern California to enclaves of Korean populations across LA and Orange County. And it expanded to New Jersey, to Manhattan, to Flushing, and even to other parts of the world, including Tokyo and Seoul. She really popularized this dish. It is not in Korean cuisine. Sundubu is not like a highly revered, incredibly popular dish. Not that it isn't good, it's delicious, yeah. But Lee Hee-suk really made it the kind of, the kind of hit dish that spread. It honestly proliferated more in the US than it did in Korea.
Yeah.
And she grew the chain. It ended up growing into this 13 location chain, and I think she really gave Korean Americans this incredible dining format. Now, it was such a popular restaurant type that she, like, there are literally imitations restaurants of BCD Tofu House across the United States. Similar menus, similar dining formats. I mean, it is you can go to a small town in the South or in the Midwest, and you might find a Korean tofu house, and it is modeled after BCD. So she, I wrote in my headline mm-hmm. that I think she put Korean food on the map. She really changed Korean cooking in America.
Matthew, let's take a pulse of Koreatown right now, because these restaurants aren't the only ones in crisis. I mean, restaurants all over the place are struggling, but are there factors that might make it more difficult for Korean restaurants to bounce back in this pandemic eventually?
Yeah, one of the things that I've sort of posited is that Korean restaurants they couldn't take advantage of the same resources that I think of mainstream restaurants were able to use, namely the Paycheck Protection Program, which was designed to help restaurants pay their staff and, you know, use a small portion of that federal government loan to, you know, pay for other expenses such as rent and utilities and whatnot. Mm-hmm. That program was poorly rolled out in the beginning. And then later on, it's become known that the PPP was not great for restaurant purposes, especially for Korean restaurants that don't have heavy payrolls, right? They don't have sommeliers and GMs and a whole slew of servers and line
different
cooks
dynamic
to put into payroll. It's different. A lot of these are family run businesses. A lot of them employ undocumented workers, and it's just, you're going to have a more difficult time for these restaurants to like apply for a federal loan and say, hey, we need $150,000 to make our payroll for the next 3 months. And here's why.
Matthew,
it's not going
to
work.
Real quick, if more closures happen in K-Town, how can the restaurant business there bounce back to the same number? Really quick.
You know, I think that the second generation of restaurateurs is nascent, and I think it's going to come in maybe a couple of years. The first generation of Korean American restaurants came out of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s.
That's Matthew Kang, editor of Eater LA. All right, that's going to do it for Take 2. We will be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.